snap. The kick is in the air, and the kick this time is no, sir, Ree. No, sir, Ree. Final score, Tennessee 20, Florida 17. Pandemonium reigns.
You're listening to the RTI Podcast, powered by RockyTopInsider.com.
Trey Wallace here, Rocky Top Insider Podcast. Happy to be joined by ESPN.com's Ryan McGee. Ryan, good afternoon to you, buddy.
How you doing, man? I feel like I'm finally coming out of my annual Daytona lack of sleep. And this year was even less sleep than normal because we were very limited in what we could do and our resources. And so I was kind of one man band in it, but I'm okay now. A couple of naps and some help from Captain Morgan. I feel better now.
There you go. What was coverage like at Daytona? How'd that go? Behind the scenes type stuff. Was it pretty crazy?
Yeah, it was different, you know, but the good news is it was back at the racetrack. Last time I was in the infield at a racetrack was Daytona a year earlier. And so I had been to a few races for ESPN right when NASCAR came back because of the first sport that came back. But that was me standing in the parking lot at Darlington, standing in the parking lot at Charlotte, standing in the parking lot at Martinsville. And so I was actually inside the racetrack. Weren't allowed in the garage, weren't allowed on pit road. The media center seats a couple hundred people. I think there were 20 of us in there. So we were socially distanced. But, you know, the best part was when the race was over with, I didn't have to fight a bunch of drunk rednecks to get to Victor Lane to interview Michael McDowell. I just casually walked through an empty picnic area. So that's selfishly, because it's all about me, selfishly, it was right. That was nice. Yeah.
What did you think, McDowell? So we get there towards the end. We knew something was going to happen with three laps to go. I didn't think we'd get down to that final lap type area. But what did you think of the ending and how things played out?
I wrote the column about it, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning that night. This is what this race is now. You know, this is the 63rd running of the race. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they're in the story on ESPN.com. I think, like, in the first 55 years, there had only been, like, a last lap lead change, like, three or four times. And now we've had it happen, like, four times in the last 6 years. And we've had a caution come out all those years. And so, you know, I think about when Ty Dillon won it. I think about when Denny Hamlin won it a year ago. I think about when Michael McDowell won it this year. This is just what this race is now. And, you know, for the casual fan, and I know the final rating wasn't what NASCAR wanted, but the initial rating when the race started that afternoon was pretty massive. I think that the crash and all that stuff is what probably those folks are looking for, but maybe the old school NASCAR fan isn't. But happy for Michael McDowell. I mean, I thought about the movie 10 Cup, right? So okay. They go to the CBS producers and directors, and they're in the truck, and they're all like, oh, who is this guy? You know, we need stars. We need stars to be winning the U.S. Open. We don't need this guy I've never heard of from a driving range in Texas. And that's how I think Fox reacted to Michael McDowell winning the race. But Michael McDowell is the best guy. And we were literally the only camera in Victory Lane. And so had a chance to sit down with him in an empty Victory Lane next to the Harley J. Earl Trophy and talk. And I'm just really, really happy for him because he just – I mean, it's 13 years. And all those years as a starting park driver. And now he's a Daytona 500 champion, and I couldn't be happier for him. But I could see where maybe the NASCAR marketing people would have chosen, like, any of the other 12 guys in that lead pack.
Well, and a lot of people forget about the starting park, and a lot of people don't understand it. But pretty much, you know, Michael McDowell is out there and just cranking the engine, going out there, maybe running two or three laps and pulling it right back in the garage just to get owner points and a little bit of money that they get at the end. So
he's just trying to hang on, right? He was just trying to stay in a race car. And so he had to do that to stay in the Cup garage. And now, I mean, the best part is it reminds me of Phil Mickelson with the green jacket. Like, he wouldn't give it back to Augusta, and he wore it all over the place. Every picture I've seen of Michael McDowell this week, he has had that trophy under his arm. He has taken it everywhere he is gone. And that's exactly how I feel like I probably would be if
that's
I won that
fantastic.
Race.
You so ESPN.com, an amazing story, and put together what you did with Dale Sr., talking about the years that has passed since then at Daytona. Putting that together, interviewing folks, going through that motion of getting everything set up for Sunday at 12 o'clock Eastern for you guys. You know so much about Dale Sr. You've written stories, you've written books. What did you take away from the story that you put out on Sunday?
Well, we're really proud of it, and I appreciate you bringing it up. And you know, I had a written piece I did for ESPN.com that was like 16,000 words when you add it all up, which is a lot for folks that don't know. And then obviously the E60 film we worked on for a year. I mean, that started with the phone call to me while I was standing outside the hospital the day after the Daytona 500 a year ago. I'm out there with the camera for SportsCenter, and they were like, hey, next year's the anniversary of Dylan Hurst's death, the 20th anniversary. In fact, that day they called was the 19th anniversary of Dylan Hurst's death. On the 18th, this is the day after Ryan Newman's crash. And we knew Ryan was going to be okay, like alive. We didn't know what his health was going to be, right, but we knew he was going to be okay. And the question was, is there a way to tie these two things together? And I'm like, yes. I mean, I've been wanting to tell this story for 20 years, which is, to me, the legacy of Dale Earnhardt when it comes to safety is every bit as important as the 7 championships and 76 wins and the Intimidator, Man in Black, and all that stuff. Now, the racers don't agree with me on that. You know, Dale Earnhardt Jr. says it in the E60. You know, when he thinks of his dad, he thinks of the racing first, not the safety. And Kyle Petty said that. Ryan Newman said he don't want to be remembered for a crash. He wants to be remembered for winning the Daytona 500, which he did. So, but to me, the reality is zero deaths in 20 years across NASCAR's top three series. And I was a young field producer for ESPN2. RPM Tonight was a show I worked on, yep, way back in the day. And I wanted to quit because I felt like I was covering more funerals than I was races. Adam Petty was my friend. Kenny Irwin Jr. was my friend. I knew Tony Roper. I knew Greg Moore. I knew Scott Brayton. You know, I felt like I was just covering funerals all the time. And Earnhardt's death was what finally woke everyone up. They could compartmentalize it. Before then, they couldn't after Superman died. Everyone felt very vulnerable. So, speaking of vulnerable, I'm so thankful to Dale Earnhardt Jr., to Kyle Petty, to Mike Helton, to Ryan Newman. And particularly when it comes to Helton and Newman, these are not gregarious, great interviews, these guys. Right. And Steve Bohannon, the doctor at Daytona, and the interviews they gave us were great. And I think that comes out in the TV show.
When you go back and look at it now, when you think of a Hans device,
yeah,
I think of Dale Earnhardt Sr.
Right.
And that's growing up on racing, you know, yeah, and that's just kind of how that is. And you see it now, and we see it in Indy. You know, we see it in NASCAR, and things have changed so much in the 20-plus years. And I think I agree. A lot of people will go down that road with you thinking when they think of Dale Sr., okay, it's like, all right, he changed the game. Unfortunately, with that accident, he changed everything, and people are safer. Because, Ryan, you know this, that hit that Newman took last year, we were all thinking the worst, unfortunately.
He dies. No, and he says it in our E60 special. You know, if he has that crash – using the technology that he started his career with, you know, his first Cup start was in 2000, and his rookie year was in 2002. And if he had that technology in that crash he had in 2020, then he's dead. And Ryan asked a question to me. This isn't in the story, but he asked a question to me. He said, well, what do you think happens if Dale Earnhardt's car goes in at a little different angle, or it doesn't pick up that burst of speed and he walks away? You know, we're praising the car that it's safe, if that, because Tony Stewart had a terrible crash 30 minutes earlier.
Yep.
And had walked away. And he said, what do you think happens then? I said, I think Jeff Gordon dies at Charlotte that May, because on the first lap of the All-Star race, Jeff Gordon, I mean, what they call a 1 o'clock angle impact, hard into the turn, where they tried to start that race in the rain. And Jeff Gordon said after the race, thank God and thank the Hans device. That's why I'm still alive. And so, I mean, it's just there's no telling what would have happened. But, yeah, it's five drivers in that first – in the 2001 Daytona 500 had head and neck restraints on. A couple other guys had been fitted for them and couldn't get it fitted in time, but five. And the next week at Rockingham, my hometown track, it was like a science fair. I mean, you should have seen all the stuff those guys had strapped to their backs and legs and necks and seats and in the cockpit, because everybody realized that, you know, if it can happen to him – it can happen to me. That's the quote from Dale Jr. that's in the show.
Putting different row bars in. I remember it.
It was crazy, man. The seats. And all of a sudden, everybody became a safety expert. I remember that. And walking through the garage in the rain that day, and it literally – all these funky window nets. And I remember we have a shot of it in the show. I can't remember who it was now, but had the extended headrest. Yeah. And had actually gotten a saw and cut a hole through it so that he could look through it, because that's what they were about, was peripheral vision. And now, you know, you look in the cockpit of these cars and just, you know, the people who all say, you know, we used to get a little bit of, well, the death is part of the lure, right? And the danger is part, whatever. I haven't heard a word out of any of them since we all thought Ryan Newman was dead a year ago. Because back right. if you were standing with me back in the day and we saw so many fatalities that you have what you call death mode, right?
Yeah.
A fatality happens to the track. All right, now we're shifting into death mode. We got to cover this. Those of us who know how to shift into death mode are way outnumbered. And those who don't know how to shift into death mode, after they got scared after Ryan Newman, I don't hear more complaints about it's too safe.
Not going to get that. Hey, I'd be remiss before we get on to Tennessee football and athletics to ask you about the partnership between Michael Jordan, Denny Hamlin, Bubba Wallace. How did you think that was rolled out? And what do you think of the future with Michael Jordan in NASCAR racing? Because he's bringing a different audience, or trying to, into the sport. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing, I think, not just Michael, but, you know, Pitbull is there. You know, I interviewed him on Sunday morning, and he's in, man. He's so, again, if you covered the sport in the 90s and 2000s like I did, then you remember, I mean, I covered so many press conferences. Brett Favre was going to be a team owner. Troy Aikman and Roger Staubach. The Wayans brothers, Jackie Joyner Kersee. I mean, it was a press conference every week announcing a new race team and a partnership, and all of that fell apart relatively quick because, you know, it's the great quote from Rick Hendrick, right? How do you make a small fortune in racing? You start with a large one. And so they realized that it's tough. It's hard. I mean, Randy Moss, I mean, all these guys that were invested in teams and went away. Nelly. And they loved it, but they just couldn't make the finances work. Michael seems committed, and Pitbull seems committed. And because of everything that we saw around Bubba, and particularly when that Confederate flag was taken down last summer, I mean, Alvin Kamara this weekend is invested in a race team. You know,
out of nowhere.
Right. And he went to Homestead, you know, after the Confederate flag was taken down, just to see what it was all like. And so the texts that I receive and the tweets that I receive from our friends who play in the NFL and play in the NBA and play Major League Baseball, or are retired athletes that I work with at ESPN, and they're texting me, what's a red flag? And what's the double yellow line rule? And, you know, and on a pit stop, so-and-so. That's, you know, they feel comfortable to follow the sport because they don't have to be uncomfortable. Driving into the infield at Daytona, I suddenly, after two or three days, realized, oh, gosh, I haven't looked to see if there's any Confederate flags. There were none. And no one cared. It didn't matter. It didn't affect anyone's ability to enjoy the race. It affected your ability to attend the race. Now you feel like you can come. So, but Michael Jordan is all in. He was around Daytona. It reminded me when they were shooting Days of Thunder 30 years ago, and everybody was like, I think I saw Tom Cruise at McDonald's. I think I saw Tom Cruise at dinner. And that's how it was with Michael. And he played a lot of golf. And then he came to the track. Yeah, he came to the track. He wasn't allowed down in on pit road all that, but he was at the track. And so I think he's committed. And the team was fast, man. Listen, what we saw out of that team, though, I think is going to be what we're going to see from them a lot this year, which is that car was fast. It looked good. It got a lot of attention. And then it had a bad pit stop. And I kind of predicted that before the race. A brand new team, that's where they're going to struggle. And so, you know, they had that violation, couldn't get through tech on Sunday morning.
Right.
And the car chief got in trouble. And a lot of that stemmed from they were trying a little last-minute pit practice, you know, before the race. And so those are the things that are going on. I mean, that team did not have a shop a month ago. I mean, they were literally just finished pouring the concrete floor at the shop, you know, in January. So there's going to be some growing pains, but I think Michael's in it for the long haul.
That's good to hear. Let's switch over to, by the way, you got a lot of Days of Thunder plug during the race.
Dude. I wrote a story last year for ESPN.com. It was the 30th anniversary of the movie.
I remember that.
And then FS1 and NASCAR Productions did a documentary that they included me in. And I watched the documentary. And I thought, man, this thing's totally based on my story. So that's why I want to interview. But yeah, I'm a Days of Thunder junkie, man. And so is Pitbull. I did not see that coming. Pitbull said he loves NASCAR because when he was a kid, he used to watch Days of Thunder all the time. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't see that coming from Mr. Worldwide.
No, I didn't see that either. And especially when it comes on, you know, you can't turn it off. So it is what it is. That's why we love it so much. Let's switch over to Tennessee football now. That's a big transition here.
Yeah.
Let's start from January back. So you look at the Jeremy Pruitt era at Tennessee. You look at the coaches that had come and gone. Philip Fulmer as the athletic director last season. I know it was COVID, but it just seemed like a lot of things going on inside that building that didn't really pertain to COVID that made things kind of go sour. Talk about the Pruitt era, what you thought that they did wrong, and maybe how do they recover from a PR standpoint?
Well, I think, unfortunately, a lot of it was predictable. I mean, I think I said this to you 3 years ago, which was I never once worried or questioned Jeremy Pruitt's ability to coach football. The X's and O's, watching film, putting in a game plan, none of that. And if you watched it on the field, he didn't necessarily have the talent to pull off what he had, but a lot of times the guys ran the right play and they got to the right place at the right time. The problem is when they got there, there was someone bigger and stronger and faster than they were. But the part I worried about from the jump was the CEO part of the job. And in particular with a job like Tennessee, it's a Power Five job. Even when they're bad, and they have been for a long time, it's still a high-profile job. There's no more passionate fan base. There's a lot that comes with that. But when you're a football coach at a program like Tennessee, when you're the first time you've ever been a head football coach, what you think you're going to do is sit down with a quarterback and go over the game plan, or sit down with your middle linebacker and go over the game plan. You're not doing any of that. What you're doing is you are fielding phone calls from the Haslams, and you are getting stopped at the grocery store, and people were questioning what you ran on third and long, or you need to take a look at my nephew, you know, who is a fullback, you know, at Farragut, you know, and then it's also your starting safety or whoever coming to you and saying, my girlfriend broke up with me, I'm going to quit the team, or a guy gets arrested, or an assistant coach does something stupid. I mean, looking at budgets, you know, handling COVID. It's all of these things that have nothing to do with football. And that's the part I was always worried about with him. And I think he walked in the building and he made the classic mistake that a guy becoming the boss for the first time makes. He made everybody mad. This is how I'm going to do it. And I don't care how y'all been doing it, but this is how Nick Saban did it. And this is how we're going to do it. And you can't walk into a building where people worked there for 40 years and make big proclamations like that and then get angry if they don't all do it. So it's it was all very predictable to me. You know, again, and football-wise, there were moments. I mean, the winning streak was the winning streak.
Yeah.
And there were moments where it looked okay. And the quarterback struggles were the quarterback struggles. We all know a lot of that. But at the end of the day, the CEO part of the job is what ate him alive. And guess what? It was a quality control thing, which is what recruiting is, that ultimately brought down that deal. And a lot of that's on Fulmer, too. It drove me insane. I mean, listen, my feelings on Phil Fulmer are well documented. This goes right back to when I was a student on the, you know, working for the football team 100 years ago. But, you know, what drove me crazy was the press conference. And the whole goal of that Monday press conference on Martin Luther King Day was to just make sure Phil was okay. Let's make sure Phil is okay. And at the end of the day, I think that's probably Phil Fulmer's goal every day he wakes up. Let's just make sure that my legacy is okay. But the reality is, yes, he won a national championship a real long time ago. But the last 5 years of his tenure are what set up the failures of the last decade plus since he was pushed out of that job. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, you can love him and you can drive down Philip Fulmer way. All that's great. But at the end of the day, he led the nation in arrests when he was the head coach. And now as the athletic director on his watch went down what's going to be the biggest recruiting scandal in the history of Tennessee football. And so, I mean, it is what it is. But the excuses and the free pass that he gets with people because he won a championship, you know, a really long time ago, drives me a little crazy. And that press conference was, I mean, I was just I just was like, are we really doing this? Are we really taking, you know, just make sure he's okay? That part drove me crazy.
And then the fact that they, you know, they gave him $37,500 a month for the next 3 years. It's like, whoa, okay.
He's long as feels good. That's all that matters. It was always going to be a temporary position, right? So I filled in. I subbed for Paul Feinbaum the day that Fulmer was announced as the special assistant to the president or wherever it was.
Right.
And he came on the show. And first time I talked to him in forever. And immediately was, I'm just going to do this temporarily. This is just me trying to help out. Well, then he becomes inner media. Oh, it's just, this is temporary. This is me just trying to help out. And, you know, everybody really knew what was going on.
You think Tennessee fans, and I'm not trying to put them all into one, but you think Tennessee fans sometimes have a hard time separating the guy that held up the trophy in Tempe, Arizona, to the guy that was running your athletic department? Because there are two big differences when it comes to this, especially the stability of the basketball program, the baseball program, the swim team. How do you think that – it just didn't feel like it gelled, Ryan?
No, and just – listen, at the end of the day, Tennessee – the athletic department of Tennessee is going to be judged by one thing, and that's the football team. And that's not fair to what that basketball team has done, because it's been pretty amazing. And it's not fair to, you know, it looks like the Lady Vols basketball are back on track, you know, and the success in all the other sports. The campus is amazing. I mean, I walk around there versus the school that I attended a long time ago. And it's just there's so many things to like about what's happening there. But at the end of the day, you're judged by the win-loss record of the football team, certainly in the eyes of the public. And it is hard to separate, you know, the guy that held up the Crystal football in Tempe a long time ago. Man, all that video is in standard definition,
right?
And all those pictures were taken with film cameras. That's how long ago that was. So. You know, and it was a great moment, but it was a really long time ago. And the reality was, it was time to move on from that a really long time ago. And the school hasn't had an ability to do that, and now they're doing it.
Before we get on the hype on Danny White, the recruiting violations, allegations that are out there, that story was put out December 19th. We sit here now 2 months later. Can this administration – and I know they hired the Glazer Group, but in your opinion, I don't know if Tennessee's ever – this has never happened really before in this manner. Can Tennessee get through this, or is this going to be 2 years of bumpy road and then we can start judging the new staff?
Oh, it's this is going to be I live in North Carolina, and work sent me to Chapel Hill a lot for years.
Yeah.
While North Carolina was going through – insanely long process of the investigation into their academic stuff, and they were guilty and everybody knew it. And in the end, I think the punishment was the cloud that hung over the program forever.
Right.
And Roy Williams having to answer questions after every win about an academic scandal. And I think that'll end up being the punishment on this. And if you're a Tennessee fan, that's about the best you can hope for, which is, you know, be punished by the longevity and the embarrassment of an investigation. So I quote one of my old college roommates from the Hill back in the day, and the text was, man, if this is all true, not only we are so stuck in the 90s, we as in Tennessee football, we're so stuck in the 90s that we even cheat like it's still the 90s. McDonald's bags and what's right out of blue chips, right?
That's so, great. Yeah, great. That's
a great. But yeah, so it's not gonna go away anytime soon. You know, certainly not the first program that's had to deal with that. It's just the first time for these guys.
Your reaction to the hiring of Danny White from UCF, you see what he does marketing-wise down in Orlando, a different ball game when you get into the SEC. We've seen how the coaching search was handled, even the staff putting that together. Your thoughts on Danny White and then the hiring of Josh Heupel?
I think that I love the hiring of Danny White. You know, I write the bottom 10 for ESPN.com, so I saw where UCF had bottomed out. And Danny White's the one to fix all of that. And he's aggressive. He doesn't take any lip. He's funny, but he's also no nonsense. And the simple fact of the matter is that Tennessee has been lost in the woods on a lot of levels. They needed an oil change. They needed somebody to come in there and just change processes. and change the way that things are being done, but also someone in a position to do that. Football kicks can't do that.
Right.
You know, the football coach thought he could do that. Pruitt did, but he couldn't do that. The athletic director could do it. All right. And so I wasn't as shocked by the hiring of Heupel as a lot of people were, just because why not for Danny White? And do I think that Josh Heupel is going to be the second coming of General Nealon? No. But I think that Josh Heupel can come in and stabilize things. And I know I'm about to say something that makes zero sense at all, but there's going to have to be some patience, because I don't think people really understand how bare the cupboard is there. I go back to when Lane Kiffin took the job and going to first spring practice and him looking at a couple of us and going, I don't have a center. Like, I don't have someone who can snap the football to the quarterback. He's calling junior colleges.
Wow.
And going, I need a center. And he couldn't believe it, because he had inherited a program coached by an offensive line coach, you know, in Fulmer. And so the point is, I don't think people understood how bad it had, the erosion had happened. And I think that maybe people don't understand that with this. So, listen, for all of the failings of the Butch era,
yeah,
there was also some success.
I agree.
And so, you know, the key is to accept the success when it comes and understand who you actually are as a program. As much as it hurts to tell my in-laws this and my wife this and my college roommates this, the goal right now is not to be Alabama. The goal is to be Auburn.
Right.
Right? The goal is to play on New Year's Day consistently. The goal is to be a threat to win 10 games, even though you might not. The goal is to have a chance to win big football games and just be in big football games. If you lose to LSU at LSU, great. But if you're in the game, that's way better than what you're doing right now. So the goal right now is to get to a certain tier, and that tier is not Alabama. That tier is somewhere in between here and Alabama for Tennessee. And so, yes, I'm asking for the impossible, which is patience. But if everybody's willing to do it, I believe that Heupel's the guy that can build the foundation to get you where you want to go. I don't know if he's going to be the guy that's going to get you to the playoff, but I think he's the guy that could certainly get you to the level that will get you to the playoff.
How does Tennessee, over the next 7 months, building up to the 21 season, how do they garner, get back to – it's going to take a minute for folks to buy back into this program. But how do you survive as an athletic department – when you know season tickets are about to be down, you know, these big orange caravans, we'll see if those type of happen. Just the atmosphere overall with Tennessee football, how do you get it to a point where at least fans are excited when Bowling Green rolls into town first week in the season?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and I don't know the answer. But I know Danny White well enough to know that marketing is kind of his thing, and hype is kind of his thing. I mean, he is literally, as we speak, walking around the building over there off of Nealon Drive with his national championship ring for a team that didn't actually win a national championship. So the ability to create energy is not a problem. I tell you this, they're going to move the football. You know, that offensive staff they've hired, all those guys ever do is eat up yardage on offense. And now they might give up a lot of yardage on defense, but that offensive staff is really good. And so I think there will be some excitement once the games start. The goal, again, if you're a Tennessee fan, and I'm asking for something that's impossible after a decade plus of struggling, decade and a half, is just accepting the little wins when you get them. And by little wins, I mean, if you hit 500 yards offense against Bowling Green, congratulations. Say thank you very much. We ain't done that in a while.
Right.
And if you end up playing in a decent bowl game, not a gimme because of a COVID, an actual bowl bid that you're playing on a New Year's Day, you say thank you very much, and just roll with whatever little success you can have right here in the short term. But I, you know, they're willing to do whatever, man. We went into this year a year ago, we're all like, oh, no one's going to get fired, you know, no one's going to make big moves because of COVID.
3 weeks into the season,
and guess what? It was business as usual. So they're writing checks to a lot of people that aren't in the building anymore. So the aggression is not going to change. I think the focus of the aggression is going to change, and that's what they need.
Hey, last thing on football real quick, for one question on basketball. The Kevin Steele thing at Tennessee.
Yeah.
How did you think of how that went down? Because now technically he really hadn't been around the building in a couple of weeks now, and on the hook for $450 a year with this thing. They're kind of, it feels like they're playing a chicken to see who's going to fire each other first. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think that hiring was obviously made by a man who didn't think his job was in jeopardy, which tells you how clueless he was.
Yeah.
And it was just weird. To me, the Steele thing is maybe the greatest illustration of what Tennessee football has been for the last decade and a half. Because it's probably the one guy you shouldn't hire. It's probably certainly the one guy that shouldn't be in the building when the best coach available is also his mortal enemy. And now Gus Malzahn's at UCF. He's in Orlando. I was down there, you know, for Daytona.
Right.
And as I'm leaving, they're like, "Can you go to UCF?" I'm like, "No, I'm going home." The whole thing is just when my boy Mark writes his sequel to The Decade of Dysfunction, Decade of Dysfunction 2, Electric Boogaloo,
yeah,
he could dedicate an entire chapter to the Steele thing. To me, it should be the opening scene because I think it sums up the going on decade plus of dysfunction.
And if nobody knows what we're talking about Mark Nagy. He put out Decade of Dysfunction. Fantastic book. I read it. I was blown away by it. But you know what?
I am quoted warmly and accurately, as I know by the hate mail I received.
People will get over it. Hey, switch over to last question. Tennessee basketball, Rick Barnes, what they've been able to do. And for a guy that a lot of people thought coming in, oh, he's just picking up a retirement check. No. The guy has put together some fantastic basketball teams, and you're starting to feel like this team might be coming together, even though it's a little spotty. Your thoughts on how he's built up the basketball program?
Well, my feeling about basketball this year is exactly what I told you and everyone else about football back in the fall, which is you get what you get and you don't pitch a fit. You know, if your team plays 19 games, great. If your team plays 28 games, great. You get whatever you get out of this year is what you get. And what he has done is pretty remarkable. And I laughed. People about the whole – he's at the end of his career and he's just playing out the string or whatever. I'm like, then you've never met Rick Barnes, because I mean, the day Rick Barnes became my hero was when he was at Clemson a long time ago and shouted down Dean Smith in the middle of a game. And I was like, this dude's the man, you know, because Dean Smith had said something to one of the Clemson players and Rick Barnes looked at him and said, "Don't talk to my players during the game." And I was like, "Wait, what?" And he was like the young buck back then. So anybody that thinks that – anybody who believed that Rick Barnes was just going to come in and, you know, win 15 games a year and mail it in and, you know, get his check and leave, they've never met that man, because he's a homeboy. He's from Central North Carolina like I am. So it's a fun team to watch. They're must-see TV. You know, if you're flipping channels and the SEC Network's got a Tennessee game on a Tuesday and Wednesday night, you got to watch. You know, basketball school, man.
Yeah. Right? Turning into it, right?
Yeah.
Is what it is. Ryan McGee, what do you got coming up over the next week or so? Do we have Marty and McGee?
Yeah. Marty McGee, Saturday morning, SEC Network and ESPN Radio, 7 to 10 a.m. And we'll both be back in the Wilderness Studio Lodge after Marty was there in the studio last week while I was down in Daytona getting rained on and getting blasted by the track dryers. Yeah. And now we'll both be back in the studio and talking Daytona 500 and talking hoops. I'm trying to get Joe Lenardi to come on, because now we're in that time of year now where bracketology is it.
Right.
I can't imagine what bracketology is like in the age of COVID. And college baseball starts today. So we'll exactly. The road to Omaha, we're back on that after a detour last summer, we're back on it. And so it's I'm starting to feel normal again, man. I got my minor league baseball schedules are coming out. I got my Smokies hat on right now. I'm ready to I feel like we're getting there. Go get my shots.
Slowly but sure.
I can go see some sports. Right.
Got that right. Ryan McGee, ESPN.com. Thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate it, buddy. Hope you have a fantastic weekend. Can't wait to watch that Daytona road course this weekend. That should be awesome.
They started at 3 o'clock on Sunday, so there's gonna be some rain. So we're ready for that. Monday. Yeah, they can race in the rain though. We'll see how that goes.
Got that. Ryan, thank you so much for joining. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, man.